And members, I'd like to call this meeting to order of the State Government Finance and Election Committee for the meeting of January 28th, 2021. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, we are doing this remotely and over Zoom. So with that, I'll have the legislative assistant call the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Here.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Here.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Here.
Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleburne?
Present.
Representative Kosnick?
Kosnick present.
Representative Mason? It looks like she's having audio issues. Representative New Brindley?
Present.
Representative Pulowski?
Present.
Representative Quam?
Present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Breck. Next we've got here is Representative Cleburne. Did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes be approved as written for Tuesday, January 26th.
A motion has been made to approve the minutes of January 26th meeting. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. This will be our first bill that we're having up. So members, we'll start out with House File 23. Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 23 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus elections bill. Representative Dabney, you want to give your explain your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping it's auspicious to kick off bill hearings in the State Government and Elections Committee. Members, House File 23 was brought to me by a constituent who serves our community as an election judge. She unfortunately cannot be here today due to other commitments. As members know, one of the strengths of Minnesota's election system is our same-day voter registration. This largely eliminates the problems that other states experience with voters not being allowed to participate, provisional ballots, and all of the problems and complications associated with them. Good on us, in short. In order to register on Election Day, you have to provide documentation of your identity, driver's license, ID card, tribal ID card, having someone vouch for you. There's some other means in statute. And establish your residency in the precinct. That can be established through a number of means, including by the voter offering bills from a set of different entities, including utilities, credit cards or bank cards, rent or mortgage documents, a student fee statement, and others. House File 23 would update that list to include medical bills that meet all of the other requirements in statute. And members, I very specifically use the term update, because my constituents' experience as an election judge has taught her what we all know. So much of our world has moved online, and old-fashioned delivered in-the-mail bills are increasingly rare. Many people use online services, automatic payment functions with their utilities and the like, and never receive that hard copy bill that's anticipated in statute. Her observation? You always get a mailed medical bill. It has all the data needed, name, address, date of service, date of the bill, required in utilities and other bills. My constituent found that medical bills were often the only bills many otherwise eligible voters still got in the mail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, Representative Dabney, do you have any testifiers that you want to for your bill?
No, Mr. Chair, as I indicated, my constituent was not able to be here today.
Thank you. Questions I have, Representative Nash.
Representative Nash. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly understand the request, and it's always good to listen to constituents when you're trying to change. That's who we work for. But, you know, Representative Dabney, this is a medical bill. Sorry, my Zoom background. This is a medical bill. that comes to our house, and it is for my oldest son. And my oldest son has graduated college. He's still on our insurance, and the bills get sent to us. But he does not live here in Waconia, and the address is here. So my concern is that this opens the door to potential fraud. And, you know, that's something that as a state representative, we all are concerned about. But if he were to be interested in voting here in the Waconia elections, or for anybody if they were living somewhere else and a kid wanted to vote in those elections, this isn't really demonstration of residency. So when he was going to college, his driver's license might have said the address here, but he and his roommates had residency, and they were they actually registered to vote in a different part of the state. Currently, he lives in Montana, and I think he's just about to change over his driver's license. But you know, this is not a bill that is inextricably linked to a geography. So a utility bill certainly is for that geography. You know, you're not going to have a bill to establish residency for somewhere that you don't actually live, but with a medical bill, you could. And that's why I'm not in favor of this bill. And I, Mr. Chair, we're laying this over for possible inclusion. I see you nodding. Okay.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. But so Representative Dabney, I can't move forward on this bill. I can't support it. And I would, if you have a retort to that, I'd be really keen to hear it. But it doesn't demonstrate a place. It just demonstrates that you got a medical service that could be mailed back to mom and dad. We're still paying for that kid, I guess. But, you know, that's just why I oppose this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nash, I'm sorry your son isn't available to vote for you.
I muddled through with an extra 10,000 votes. It was okay.
All right. I did have the unique experience of my youngest turning 18 a few weeks before the 2020 election, and taking him to a vote center and getting him registered, and I didn't look over his shoulder when he filled out the ballot, because it is a secret ballot. But I'm hoping that I had his vote that day. But Representative Nash, we know that fraud is not a meaningful element of Minnesota elections. We're strong in the protections that we provide. So I am not overly concerned about fraud in our elections when we ask people to provide the level of documentation for those who register same day. There's no evidence of fraud being a meaningful part of our election experience here in Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Dabney, you know, he did vote for me a couple times before he finally moved out of the house, which was celebrated by all, I guess, to some level. But that you don't believe fraud happens, that's a whole other conversation. But you know, we're creating law here, and we should take into consideration the possibility of it in the policies that we make. And whether you believe it's happened in the past, you shouldn't make it easier in the future to possibly carry it out. And that's something that I take very seriously in the laws that I carry, or in the bills that I carry as an author and some become law. I do believe that it does make it easier to carry out a potential fraud. And I haven't heard you discount the fact that it could. And that's my concern is what do we do in our laws, our bills, and different things like that, that could create an opportunity to carry out fraud. So I by virtue of this example alone, and I'm sure there are countless other examples, I can't support this. So thank you.
The next I have on my list, and her hand's not up anymore, but Representative New Brindley, did you have a question?
That's fine, Mr. Chair. I actually had the same point as Representative Nash, that a medical bill is actually not indicative of residency. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam, and members, we have another bill that's probably going to take a lot more time, so let's not filibuster this one, because the other one we're going to vote on, and we will vote on it before the end of committee. So we can spend the whole hour and a half on this and not have much time for the other one, or we can get ready to move on this. We're just going to be laying this one over. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really am disappointed that we, you know, should try and rush through discussion of such an important bill. I would have to also let the author know that, frankly, the Legislative Audit Commission did do an audit a few years ago that went through and found tens of thousands of bad registrations. In fact, one cycle, it was 15,000 that came back as bad registration, more than 15,000 came back as bad registrations. When verified, the part of HAVA that we do have in Minnesota, of where we verify through the secretary or the Social Security Administration website. And there was another cycle, over 16,000 bad registrations just from there. That's not including the ones that come up with the address is bad, et cetera. And, you know, frankly, I think we should not trivialize the verifications that we have, such as this past cycle not having a witness signature. Statute says that's part of our election integrity and verification, but apparently outside the legislature and the U.S. constitutional thing that the legislature is what is to change the laws, that was ignored. The mailing of a medical bill, let's touch on that. Well, one of the legislators that the author served with and the chair served with, in fact, served decades on our in our chamber, had an issue, and I think that was during a primary, where hundreds of people were registered at a P.O. box door, and when I moved from one house to another and I was looking at moving, I did the precaution of shifting some of my mail to a P.O. box, and actually I used that for several years after I moved because it was handy to pick that up. So if a medical bill with a mailed somewhere, and I print mine off from online, but a medical bill doesn't necessarily designate where you sleep. I mean, I know people in past whose bedroom was in one district and their address of the house was considered in a different one. And I remember that from the last time we did redistricting and, you know, some of the discussions that came up. But getting back to the address thing is that when we had a sampling of the registration, it did come up that we verified, and there were multiple people voted illegally, and it was determined that they voted illegally through the P.O. box door. It's also been determined that same-day registration has allowed thousands of bad registrations to be done, and votes cast, and because we're one of the three states in the United States with an exemption to provisional ballots, that those votes were cast and run through, even though there were bad registrations. There have been challenged votes that have been found to be bad. In fact, thousands one election cycle. It wasn't being investigated or pushed. Oh, there wasn't any fraud. And then billboards went up. And when it became public that thousands of bad registration, thousands of people that voted did not vote legally. I was hoping the original author, who has some background in election law, would be here for some questioning, because frankly, those thousands that were acknowledged were not legally cast. Several hundred were taken to court and convicted, and that was because our law makes it intent to perform fraud. So it doesn't protect you and me who cast legal votes from having illegal votes counted. And in the thousands, because that's been verified, you know, you can't dispute what's happened and has been verified. And we've had statewide elections that have turned on a few hundred votes. So I'm disappointed this bill is further weakening the verification process, opening up to increased opportunity for fraud, of which there's documented fraud related to this type of activity. And I'm just disappointed that in this time when a large portion of the population has concerns, that we aren't instead increasing our verification, our checks and balances, to give our citizens higher confidence in our system. So I would love if this is laid over to work with the author to try and put in actual improvements to verification and making our system more, I guess, acceptable to our citizens and voters. So, you know, is the author willing to work offline to improve this bill?
Representative Kwong, we are laying this over for possible inclusion, so there'll be plenty of time to work on to do that, and I'm sure the Representative Dabney would be willing to do that. Our Secretary
Mr. Chair, can the author actually answer the question? I would not.
Representative Kwong, I'm in control of this meeting. Representative Kwong, I'm going to call the Secretary of State. You've made some accusations about illegal voting, and I would like the Secretary of State to be able to answer some of those questions of this case you cited. If you have public, if you have documents that state what show what you say happened, but bring those forward to the committee. But we'll let the Secretary of State answer some of what you said, some of your accusations. Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McQuinn. I appreciate it. And I don't want to hijack this committee hearing, and there'll be plenty of time on the next bill and in future hearings to discuss it. Representative Kwong is just thoroughly and repeatedly wrong on basic facts, on truth, on objective truth. It's not true. Much or most of what he said is just false. And I don't want to belabor the point and talk about that. The election in 2020 was fair, accurate, honest, secure, period. The demonstrable instances of misconduct in the state are minuscule. A Trump-appointed federal district court judge recently in this last election pored over the records over the last 40 years, I think dated more than that, to 1979, and found that at least in one category, level of fraud was 0.00045%. That's it, minuscule. And so those are the facts. And sometimes facts are inconvenient and they're stubborn, but those are the facts. To this bill, you know, I hadn't talked to Representative Dabney about it. This kind of thing is typically and usually done in terms of proofs for registration. This kind of thing is typically done via rulemaking, although, of course, legislative action always trumps rulemaking. And so it's perfectly appropriate to do it here. I would just point out, though, that all the usual checks would be in place. There's a long list. You can go to our website at mnvotes.org. This has been very bipartisan over the year. There are a long list of proofs in Minnesota that can be used for voter registration. And remember, when you zoom out on voter registration, we really ask people to do two things. You have to show that you are who you say you are and that you live where you say you live. That's it. That's all that voter registration is. And we have a pretty long list of documents that can be provided to do either or both of those things. And I think what Representative Dabney is saying is add this one to the list. And by adding it to the list, there would still be all the checks in place. For example, you can't do a P.O. box. That may have been the case years and years ago, but now we work very, hand in glove with USPS, P.O. boxes. You just can't do it. In limited circumstances, like if you're in the Safe at Home program, a P.O. box is okay. But other than that, you can't. You would still have to swear under oath. You would still have to provide with a medical bill or any other kind of bill, some sort of photo component. So you'll see, and this is all laid out on the website. I don't have it in front of us, but the rule of longstanding under Democrats, Republicans, secretaries of different parties is it usually takes two documents, right? So you couldn't just come in and say, hey, here's my medical bill. That alone probably wouldn't be need another corroborating piece of documentation. So that really is what we have for decades. This isn't new. This isn't a party thing. You are who you are, say you are. You live where you say you live. And we have a long list of documents. From what I can tell, Representative Dabney is just suggesting that this should be on the list along with utility bills, along with other kinds of bills or information that we already have. So all the checks would be in place that we have now.
Representative, our Secretary Simon. Representative Duskowski, we'll take your question, and then we're going
Mr. Chair, the Secretary of State impugned what I stated and actually was Quam? Before our committee in the past. In fact, if you look at committee minutes over the past few sessions, there's actually it was government operations because the name changes. But we had
Quam,
testimony
Quam,
in regards to what was stated. So if you allow the Secretary of State to impugn a member of the committee and not allow that member to be able to have a voice, then you're also doing the same thing that was done the last election, is the Secretary of State can override and do what he wants to do, and the legislature supposed to be able to do it.
Representative Quam, if you don't stop, I'm going to have you muted. We're moving on to Representative Duskowski. Representative Duskowski, you can answer your question, and after we get that question, we're going to move on to our next bill. We'll lay this bill over, and we can work on it more in the future. Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was intrigued by the same discussion and the assertion by the bill author that there was no fraud in Minnesota. Members in the Democrat primary election in 2020 in the city of Minneapolis, the same city that the author of the bill that just testified there's no fraud in Minnesota lives in, an individual named Liban Mohammed illegally harvested 300 ballots that he stole from elderly Somali American people in Ward 6 in Minneapolis, took their ballots from them, and in one day he had 300 ballots in a self-made video that are on video. And Mr. Chair, I would like to bring the video before the committee and show it. You asked if we could bring evidence forward. I have it, and I would like to show the committee in the future. This video is a self-made video, self-admission by the person who made the video, showing that they had 300 ballots that weren't theirs in their car. Evidently, as you see in the video, many of them are still unsealed. They're still open. And he acknowledged that every one of those 300 ballots, which was one day's take for Mr. Mohammed, were filled out for his brother, Jamal Osman, the city council candidate in Ward 6 in Minneapolis, who won the election. Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, Secretary of State Simon, we have fraud in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Duskowski. And members, with that, we'll lay this bill over. Thank you, Representative Dabney, and for bringing it forward. And we go be further discussions. And if there is proof, then you have that. When we bring this forward in the future, we can see that we can present that at that time. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Secretary Simon. Thank you, members.
With that, members, we're going to move on to, we've laid this bill over for possible inclusion in an election bill in the future. Next bill we have on it is House File 9. This bill has to go to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Representative Greenman, if you want to make a motion on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move, I have an author's amendment to put this bill in the...
Representative Greenman, first we have to get the bill before. So move House File 9 to move to Judiciary, this first step.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 9 to Judiciary.
To be referred to House?
To be referred to a Judiciary. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The bill's before us now, and I understand you have an author's amendment. Representative Greenman, you want to move your author's amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move my author's amendment. It's just cleanup to put it in the shape that I want to present it.
Representative Greenman moves her the A2 author's amendment. All in favor of allowing moving the A2 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The bill's in the shape that you want it. Representative Greenman, please explain your bill. And I see we have a few testifiers for this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'm grateful to be here this morning to offer House File 9. It is a comprehensive democracy bill that defends, strengthens, and modernizes Minnesota's best traditions of voter participation, of sound elections administration and trusted local elections officials, of transparency in government, and of grassroots campaigns and voter and small dollar support. The package combines common sense solutions that rests on the premise that our state works best when Minnesota voices are at the center of our democracy. All Minnesotans, Black, Brown, Indigenous, White, Metro and Greater Minnesota, rich and poor, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and folks who don't have a party at all. Minnesota voters, not corporations, not national voices, are at the center of our democracy. And the last year, democracy has been tested. We conducted a presidential election during a global pandemic that required a really Herculean effort by elections officials and Minnesotans to ensure we had a safe, secure, and well-run election. In 2020, over 30,000 local elections officials and election judges, our friends and neighbors, folks who live in our communities from every corner of the state showed up. They put their health on the lines in some cases to help us conduct an election that was secure and safe. And like in other policy areas, the pandemic exposed some of the cracks, the inefficiencies, the disparities in our voting system. And we also learned things about what voters liked and the things that worked and ways we could modernize and standardize our processes about how Minnesotans are casting their ballot and how we're administering elections. This year also saw our democracy tested by a rising climate of disinformation and rhetoric and fear of intimidation. Here in Minnesota, we saw it with a private firm, Atlas Aegis, reported to be recruiting armed security contractors to come potentially be at polling places. Well, the good work of our Attorney General's offices and the Secretary of State's office prevented this intimidating conduct in 2020. We have seen the threats and intimidations of voters and elections officials rise across the country. And just 3 weeks ago, we witnessed the dangerous consequences of that rise of disinformation and harassment targeting our elections. This election also highlighted problems that Minnesotans have been talking about and the legislature has been talking about for years. Ever more money in our elections, dominated by big donors and outside spending. Since Citizens United a decade ago, there's been an explosion of spending by outside groups, by independent expenditures that are not accountable to voters or to candidates, and in many cases, voters and candidates may not even know who's funding them. Here in Minnesota, our disclosure laws haven't kept pace. In fact, followthemoney.org currently gives Minnesota an F for disclosure of outside spending. And since the 90s, Minnesota has counted on our public financing system to counter some of the impacts of big money to ensure that Minnesota candidates of all parties can run on the strength of voter support and not just on how much money they raise. Our public financing system is used by candidates of all major parties. 86% of candidates for the legislature in 2020 participated in the system. But over the decades, it hasn't kept up, and we've been making it increasingly hard for candidates and grassroots candidates to rely on the program to run campaigns. And the Popular Political Contribution Refund, which is a program that allows Minnesotans to support any candidate they choose that's participating, is a little clunky, and it's hard to use, and it requires Minnesotans to lay out up to $50 and wait for their refund, and many folks don't have that. This bill responds to the urgent and the overdue with reforms to make our voting system more accessible in Minnesotans in four major ways. First, it defends voters and strengthens the right to vote for Minnesotans. It includes a strong provision to protect voters and elections officials and volunteers from intimidation and harassment. It gives law enforcement the tools they need to fight the deceptive practices and acts of disinformation that are intended to interfere with the vote. It strengthens the right to vote with policies that we've seen in states across the country, blue states, red states, purple states, to modernize and expand our voter registration system with automatic voter registration, pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, and restoring the right to vote for those Minnesotans who are living in our community on probation and parole. And it also ensures equitable access to opportunities to vote early, absentee, and in person. With these provisions in place, our dedicated elections officials will have the tools and resources they need to ensure that eligible Minnesotans can confidently cast their ballot in a safe, secure, and smooth election. Secondly, it ensures Minnesotans know who's spending in our elections by increasing transparency and disclosure of secret spending. It closes dark money loopholes and requires disclosure of the top three donors to groups spending money in our elections, so voters know who's trying to influence all of our votes. Third, it empowers voters in our elections by modernizing the PCR, the political contribution refund, into a democracy dollars coupon that will be available to all Minnesota voters, all registered Minnesota voters, to support any candidate of their choice. And it would strengthen our public financing system by replacing the public subsidy grant with a small dollar match to increase the influence of the voters and small donors in our districts and the state. And lastly, it provides fair criteria and transparency and public input in the redistricting process to ensure that the lines that shape our democracy are drawn to represent the voices of our communities and of Minnesotans. We've seen our democracy tested in unimaginable ways, and there are still challenges ahead. But in Minnesota, we've come together to tackle big challenges before. And I think I can't think of a more important effort in starting 2021 than working together on these common sense reforms to defend and strengthen our democracy so that Minnesota voters and our communities are at the center of the work we're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there are testifiers.
And members, we're going to save the questions till after the testifiers so we can let the public get in on this. First person on my list is Secretary Simon. Secretary Simon, if you want to state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I'd like to say a lot of the time that I'm in the democracy business, and business did very well in 2020. And democracy works in Minnesota year in and year out. I think we just saw evidence of that a couple months ago. In 2020, the election in Minnesota was fair, honest, accurate, and secure. And for the third election in a row, despite a once-in-a-century pandemic, Minnesota was number one in the country in voter turnout, just shy of 80%, 79.96%. And I don't think that's an accident or a coincidence. I think that's the result of a lot of people, including on this committee of both parties, by the way, creating the framework for that to happen, and a lot of people in election administration around the state doing a really good job under really, really challenging conditions. And I think it's also a reflection, at least in part, of the overall confidence that the system enjoys and of the great strides that we've made as a state in terms of accessibility of voting. But even in Minnesota, there's room to grow. There's room to improve. There's room to do better. And our democracy can be even more accessible, more fair, and more transparent. I think a fair question to ask ourselves is, hey, we're at nearly 80%. What about those other 20%? Why aren't they voting? And I'm the first to admit that some of that is beyond the purview of the legislature. Some of that, you're not going to pass a law to get at that. Some of that is, people's views of the system. But part of that, of course, does lie with better laws. So I think this bill is part of that conversation. It's maybe certainly a first step, and maybe more than that, in that conversation of how can we do better, how can we be better. So we tend to talk a lot about our election system. We use that term a lot, system. But a system is more than just machines and processes and rules. A system is ultimately about people. We all know that. Any healthcare system, election system. And this bill moves our democracy forward by empowering people. It includes reforms, I should point out, that have enjoyed bipartisan support across the country, things that Democratic and Republican legislators and Democratic and Republican governors have signed off on, things that I've talked about over the years before many of you here in this committee, things like streamlined voter registration, things like more direct access to absentee balloting, or pre-registration for high school students, or fair redistricting principles, or restoration of voting rights to people who have left prison behind. So overall, I think the bill would make voting more accessible, not less. It would expand voting rights, not shrink them. It would make elections more secure, not less secure. And it would make campaigns more relevant to more people, not more remote. So I want to thank Representative Greenman for initiating what is a conversation. And now I think is not the time to rest on our success. Now is the time to take the next step to make our nation leading democracy in Minnesota even better. Thank you, members.
Next person. The next person on my list is Attorney General Keith Ellison. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. And if the Secretary of State is in the democracy business, I am in the justice business. And I want to thank you for having me today. Representative Greenman, thank you for bringing this important bill forward. I primarily want to focus on Article 3, and that enacts new laws governing voter intimidation, interference, and deceptive practices. The bill before you expands the scope of the Attorney General's jurisdiction to include civil investigation and enforcement of regulating voter intimidation, interference, and deceptive practices in elections. The reason this is important is that there is a gap in the civil law. Currently, voter intimidation provisions is a criminal law matter which requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt and which may give fewer tools for stopping more imminent threats, including things like short of an arrest, there's not clear mechanism for something like an injunction. Expressly given the Attorney General's office, civil enforcement will allow us to act swiftly to enforce Minnesota's voter protection laws and protect democracy and promote justice. It's a provision that we have, that we could have had during the last election, which would have been very beneficial. Some of you may have seen in the news that in the middle of October 2020, my office launched an investigation into a Tennessee-based security company, Atlas Aegis, that purportedly was recruiting private security guards, military personnel, and law enforcement to be near polling places in Minnesota. Tennessee company. After our investigation was initiated, we settled with the company and were able to enter into what we call an assurance of discontinuance, basically a settlement agreement where the company agreed to do the following. One, not seek to intimidate voters in Minnesota or anywhere in connection with the election. Not provide protective agent services in Minnesota from October 2020 2020 through January 2022. And they also agreed to communicate to each and every listserv, job board, and individual to whom it originally sent its request for election security guards in Minnesota that it was wrong to suggest the scope of work included, quote, protection of election polls. There was no need for that. They weren't threatened. Now, that particular case happened to work out under current law because we were able to settle in such a speedy fashion. However, the law that gave us the authority to investigate that company and seek information about their election interference activity requires giving 20 days to respond. But we were less than 20 days away from the election, so we had to get a court order to shorten the response time to 10 days. Had the companies not cooperated or taken the full time to respond, waiting on information could have prevented us from taking action as the election neared, came closer. The proposal before you would result in a clearer path to protecting voters from intimidation and interference and prevent deceptive practices that inhibit participation in a free and fair election. These provisions, along with the rest of the bill, including the re-enfranchisement of Minnesotans with a criminal record, allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to register early, establishing automatic voter registration, and making it easier for all Minnesotans to participate in democracy, makes this a great bill, and I certainly hope you support it. And Mr. Chair, at this time, I yield back.
Thank you, Attorney General. The next person on our list is Mr. George Beck, and if you want to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And if you can, turn your video on. Mr. Beck.
Chair Nelson, members, thank you very much. My name is George Beck. I'm a retired administrative law judge and a former chair of the Campaign Finance Board. I now chair Clean Elections Minnesota, and I'm also representing this morning the Minnesota Alliance for Democracy, a group of about 12 democracy groups, including Common Cause Minnesota. We all strongly support House File 9. It's a comprehensive bill that will make Minnesota a leader in the nation in democracy reform. Very importantly, it finally takes steps to lessen dark money in Minnesota by expanding the definition of expressly advocating so that contributors cannot hide their identity when supporting independent expenditures. This change has been supported by the Campaign Finance Board and adopted in 19 other states, but not in Minnesota. This reform does not deny free speech, but asks who is speaking. We conducted a poll last fall through St. Cloud State University, and one of the questions had to do with disclosure. And what we found was that 82% of the people in Minnesota support full disclosure of all political contributions. This bill also adopts an innovative approach to campaign financing by proposing a democracy dollar small donor match program. Registered voters would receive a $50 coupon from the state that they could provide to any candidate of their choosing. There's been an unfortunate effect nationally and in Minnesota to suppress votes and narrow the electorate. This bill creates automatic voter registration, early voting before an election, the mailing of absentee ballots to registered voters, and restoration of the right to vote for those who have been previously incarcerated. It discourages the intimidation of voters. This will combat voter suppression, which is alive and well nationally and in our state, and ensure a robust vote in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. The next person on my list is Pastor James Albert. And if you want to, can introduce yourself for the record and can turn your video on so that we can see you when you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the committee members, I want to thank you for your time on this morning. My name is Pastor James Alberts. I serve at Higher Ground Church of God in Christ in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I am also president of the board of Isaiah, a nonprofit organization that represents several other faith-based organizations across the state of Minnesota. I want to thank you for considering House Bill 9. This is an opportunity for Minnesota to continue to lead into the future in the way of establishing further freedoms for individuals inside of the state of Minnesota so that we can lead the state in such this pivotal area and at such a pivotal time. This past summer, we were able to, we experienced a great deal of strife and turmoil, but we also were able to see the power and the ability for expression to actually change systems and systematic injustices that have existed and have continued to thrive. We want to make sure that the world continues to watch the state of Minnesota as we emerge from the moments of social tragedy with a plan and a purpose to change what needs to be changed and double down on what has worked before. And we want to develop new solutions for the things that we have yet to overcome. This opportunity it is not a once in a lifetime, but it is a once in a generation opportunity for us to take seriously what is sitting before us. We want to be leaders in this most dynamic time, not just for our generation or for those of us that are sitting in this meeting right now, but also for those generations that are yet up and coming. This bill will allow for there to be freedom of expression for all Minnesotans and not just for a limited few. And for those that have given their time and met their obligations to the system, they will be allowed an additional level of freedom that will give them time and opportunity to be a part of this most sacred act of being an American citizen. I want to thank you, the committee, and thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to be able to speak to this. And I hope that you would support the furtherance of this bill to the next levels. Thank you once again.
Thank you. Thank you, Pastor. The next person on my list is Arlene Gatu. I hope I said that right.
That's correct.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Arlene Gatu, and I live in St. Paul. I spent most of my career working in communications at major corporations in Minnesota and Chicago. My job was to defend them through my work in media and public relations. In 2003, I was first exposed to community organizing here in Minnesota, and it opened my eyes to the truth I had overlooked. Corporations only look out for themselves. As a corporate employee, I was told time and again their most important resources were their employees. They said things like, we're a team, we're in this together, when in reality, employees were the first to go when times got tough and profits were down. Corporations say shareholders come first, yet some of the biggest shareholders are those self-same executives and CEOs. I learned corporate interests are very different from the community's interests. Yet corporations and other special interests have massive influence on who runs for office and what issues they decide to talk about. I often felt pressure to give to the company's corporate PAC, unsure whether or not my job security would be on the line if I didn't contribute. Oftentimes, I wasn't told where my money would go or what it would end up influencing. It is absolutely essential that we change our current system to limit the influence of these actors. In this last presidential election, we saw an influx of grassroots donors who felt empowered to elect leaders that represented them and their communities. But corporations funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars through many different and often dark channels. To create a system that works for all, we need to expand access to voting and make it possible for people's voices to count through both their vote and financial means. Right now, we are currently at a disadvantage against corporations. We have to close the loopholes in our campaign finance system and restore power to Minnesotans. I think this bill is a necessary step in the right direction to do just that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Datu. The next person on my list is Sandy Grandmason. If you want to introduce yourself for the record, and I see you took your video on. Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Grandmason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandra Grandmason. I am co-president of the League of Women Voters of Duluth, and I work as an election judge for Precinct 23. The mission of the League of Women Voters is to protect democracy by ensuring free and fair elections. We do this by registering and educating voters, assisting with at-home voting, and informing ex-felons of their voting rights when appropriate. The COVID-19 pandemic and the hyper-partisanship surrounding the past election made me question my safety as an election judge. It has always been challenging to engage volunteers to work the polls. After this election, it will be even more difficult because of the misinformation and fear spread by some of our federal and state legislators who refuse to acknowledge the 2020 presidential election results and perpetuate the lie that the election was somehow stolen and fraudulent. This puts poll workers in danger. I recently spoke with Duluth City Clerk Chelsea Helmer, who described the high level of harassment and intimidation aimed at our election judges and managers. The threat of violence hanging over this election forced the city of Duluth to work closely with law enforcement and prepare election workers for possible threats beyond those posed by COVID-19 pandemic. This is unacceptable. Election judges and election officials face two significant threats. One, politicians who promote disinformation and divisiveness through angry rhetoric that put us all in danger. And two, intimidation of voters and election judges, including with weapons. When I showed up at my polling site, a church, I assumed that guns were banned. But when I arrived to work the polls, I found that this was not the case. Weapons are not banned from polling places in Minnesota. This legislation protects poll workers from intimidation in this environment of heated rhetoric where people are carrying weapons into polling places. If we do not protect our election workers, we will not have qualified people to do the work necessary to protect our electoral process. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grand-Mason. The next person is on the list is Glenn Brown. Again, please identify yourself for the record, and if you can turn on your video.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Peace and blessings to all. My name is Glenn Brown, and I'm a proud member of the Barbershop and Black Congregation Cooperative. I'm grateful to be here with you guys today. Thank you for giving me this platform. I grew up in Chicago, and I moved to Minnesota in 2008. So I've been a citizen for quite a bit of time. I'm a father of four. I have three young African-American males. I have one beautiful daughter. I'm happily married, and I'm a business owner, and I'm an investor. I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. Growing up in Chicago wasn't always easy. You know, I grew up in a crime-infested area, and I have been quite a bit in my lifetime. I mean, I've been in and out of prison, and I know that God has blessed me. He's changed my life around for the better. He's did supernatural acts in my life, and I know he's using my life to lift people up, to give people hope, give people direction. And I'm grateful for this platform to be able to speak in support of this bill. I was never a big fan of politics, but I never saw it as a way to bring people together. But as I watched BBCC's organizing and just bringing people together, reaching out to the community, my perspective changed. I decided, like, why sit back on the sideline? Let me try to contribute to my community to make it better. And I deeply believe that people need it for progress, hope, and change. Democracy is very important. I feel it's a form of structure. It's a form of unity. And when you use correctly, it brings a lot of the diversities of the state of Minnesota, the country, and the world. It brings many diversity together. And of course, we all going to have different points of view, but we all are living on this earth, and we all here for a reason. It's important for us to listen well to our leaders, but it's also important to be heard too as well. No matter what race, creed, or color, or gender, we all should have their right and their freedom to express ourselves. I believe so much in the power of voting, and my goal is to bring awareness to that power. at one point in my life, I didn't even know I had the power to vote. You know, I was in and out of being incarcerated. I didn't know when or how I could vote because no one ever told me, no one ever brought awareness to ensure that I was included in the voting process. And when I reflect back on that time, it made me feel like I was inadequate. You know, as a civilian, I felt like I was just a jail number. I felt my rights to vote in the state didn't have any value. But through my organizing work with BBCC, I found a lot of my Black brothers and sisters feel the same way. Even in the midst of this past election, this past campaign, you know, reaching out to people trying to express the power of voting, I heard a lot of people didn't have their hope and that enthusiasm to use their voting. But I pressed forward. I continue to ensure them that it's your voice means a lot. I think that we need a collective understanding among community leaders, organizers, agencies, elected officials, and other leaders. We need to instill confidence and self-worth in people who are returning to society. We need them to understand that it's a place for all of us. And this is powerful work in voting. It's a powerful tool. And we have to do a lot to ensure that we are working together for a democracy that works for all of us. And in closing, I just encourage all the elected officials, just allow this message to go, you know, to your heart. You know, go through your ears and to your heart. Just think about the people that's in your life. You know, let it go even a little deeper. Just put put one of your family members in the position. What would you do for them? I know you would advocate for them. So we need to always be mindful of the others that's out here that's really demanding for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. God bless.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. The next person on the list, and if we can be a little more concise, we need to get to questions, and we don't want to use up the whole time. So the next person on my list is Mary Jill Maleka. I hope I said that last name right. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
My name is Mary Jill Maleka. You were very close. And I'm a member of St. Joan of Arc in South Minneapolis, and we are a congregational member of Isaiah. I live in New Brighton, and I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. I retired 6 years ago as a senior vice president after spending my career in international marketing research. I retired early because what I saw corporate America doing to its employees, real people, didn't feel right to me. I grew up in a home with a father who quit high school to fight in World War II. And as he reminded me often, people fought and died for the right to exercise our voice. Voting was non-negotiable, a sacred American right. Unfortunately, it isn't that way for everyone. For years, I've dedicated my free time to get out the vote efforts, both on the phone and knocking on doors. I specifically remember standing on people's front steps in North and South Minneapolis, grown men tearing up as they told me they weren't able to vote because they were still on paper. Their agency had been stripped away by a system that should be protecting their sacred right. In the 2020 election, I was a democracy captain with Faith in Minnesota. I had a group of 22 volunteers who built relationships in districts across the state with their assigned list of voters. Through that experience, I saw people go from not thinking that their voice means anything to being in front of the room, telling their story, harnessing their power, and participating in our democracy. The more people who participate in our democracy, the stronger it is. The whole point of democracy is to include the voices of all people. We can't leave anyone behind. We should be doing everything we can to enfranchise people to vote and increase the influence of grassroots efforts. I support this bill's goal of putting people back at the center of our democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. And the next person on my list is Sean Lim. You can identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, that's right. Hello. Thank you, Chair Nelson and members, for having me. My name is Sean Lim. I'm 21 years old and currently serving as the lead campus organizer at the U of M for the nonprofit Minnesota Youth Collective. And I'm very grateful for Representative Greenman for putting forth House File 9. As an electoral youth and community organizer, I've been registering my neighbors and fellow Minnesotans to vote in local, municipal, state, federal elections since before I could even vote myself. Since the 2018 midterms, I've helped provide students on campus and young folks aged 18 to 36 with the tools and knowledge that they need to successfully participate in our elections, including walking folks through the complex voter registration process. And so today I'd like to focus especially on automatic voter registration, or AVR, which is on page 10 of this bill. In countless ways, the implementation of AVR would set the foundational groundwork for an increase in voter turnout by dismantling the numerous existing roadblocks to democratic participation that folks have. And so I'm a strong proponent of AVR because it would, as the name implies, automatically register young voters to be ready to cast their ballot when they turn 18. It would save the state precious money, time, and resources over time and ensure a more robust and accessible democracy for all. I know that it would certainly make the job of grassroots organizers like me easier and greatly increase turnout across the state of Minnesota, as Secretary Simon mentioned, which already has the highest in the country, 3 national elections in a row. And so I firmly believe that we do need to expand the number of registered voters. AVR does just that. It allows 16 and 17-year-olds to pre-register to vote, as Representative Greenman mentioned. It empowers young people to be set and ready to cast their ballot the moment they turn 18. And so I'm very excited about what this means for high schoolers and the fostering of youth civic engagement in our state. It is proven through research that folks who participate in their first eligible election are more likely to consistently vote in every other election for the rest of their lives. And so, more importantly, back-end AVR is—
Mr. Lim, if you can wrap up.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to conclude, right now, 23 states plus DC have already implemented or are in the process. So I urge you all and your colleagues to support Greenman's legislation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Lim. The next person is Mohammed Shali. I hope I said that correctly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
You got it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure for me to be part of this crucial meeting. My name is Mohammed Shale. I'm a member of a Muslim Muslim Coalition of ASEA. In 2010, I just came to USA from Somalia after living in a refugee camp in Kenya for 23 years. I live in St. Cloud for the past 8 years. I'm a business owner of a mental health recovery and a leader in a Muslim community in St. Cloud. I believe in a democracy democracy's ability to promote equality regardless of race, gender, or religion. We have all the tools to promote equity, but our system isn't working for everyone. This year was my first time of voting. I went in person and I was so excited. I finally felt the power in my hands to choose the person I wanted to be first. Represent me and my community. I want to organize community members to turn out and exercise this power. We encourage so many people to show up who otherwise were not going to because they didn't believe it will work, it will make a difference for them. Despite being so excited to vote, I checked my voting status and saw that my vote was never counted. No one reached out to me. I was left wondering if it was my fault or the fault of the rigged system. I discouraged. It also happened to others. When I found out, I was temporarily discouraged, but I'm not going to give up. I fear other members of my community whose votes were not counted may. We need to make our system more accessible with better educational resources to ensure all of our voices are being heard. We need to make sure everyone, every person feels safe and welcome at our polling location and our politics. I support this bill to make sure that happens. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Shelley. And our last testifier.
I have a point of order or just a question, if I could.
Representative Koznick, quickly. I'm trying to get to questions, and this is the last, one last testifier, and then we'll get to questions. So, Representative Koznick.
Well, I understand that. I was wondering, Mr. Chair, this bill is like 70 pages long, has a pretty deep fiscal note, and I was wondering, are we going to have an opportunity to get a walkthrough on the kind of the details of the legislation? I believe this testimony is important to hear, but we are running out of time. So what is the plan for the committee to have that?
Ms. Representative Koznick, I have one last testifier. We can have Ms. Roberts quickly go through the fiscal note. A lot of the parts of the fiscal note don't pertain to us, pertain to other committees. And that's why we're trying to get this moved down to the other committees so they can have their discussions also. Representative Koznick, the next person I'm going to speak is Stephanie Strassel. I'm sorry, put an R in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
State your name for the record.
My name is Stephanie Stasel. I am also a leader in Isaiah, and I believe deeply that our government needs to protect all the people of our country. In 2017, I was committed to voter turnout and reached out to the people in my parish. I connected with the 67-year-old man who was convinced that he could not vote due to a prior felony charge long ago. He was no longer on paper, so I confirmed his right to vote with Ramsey County Elections and brought him his registration form. We drove together to the primary. I swear he grew 6 inches while he was voting. It was the first time ever, at the age of 67, this man exercised his voice in our democracy, believing all along that he could not. I am also an election judge and chose to do so this year because I am healthy and I am committed to helping people vote. Yet I found myself frustrated that some people were trying to make voting more difficult, not more accessible. The narrative to undermine vote by mail's credibility was very harmful. I'm not typically a worrier, but I and my fellow election judges were very anxious about both our health and our safety and did worry about violence at the polls. We have elected officials right here in Minnesota making false claims of voter fraud, undermining our election systems and making it more difficult for people to vote. We need to feel like our elections are safe, reliable, and accessible to all in order to participate. The elements of this bill to expand access to our elections and protect voters is absolutely essential to move toward a fully inclusive democracy. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
Thank you, Ms. Stossel. Ms. Roberts, if you want to quickly go through the preliminary fiscal note for us, and then we're going to get to questions. Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, would you prefer that I share my screen to show the fiscal note?
Yes, you can go ahead and do that, yes. It should have been sent to everybody, but.
Okay. Very quickly, this is a preliminary fiscal note for the bill. The agencies are listed on the top left corner, and the agencies under this committee's jurisdiction are Administrative Hearings, the Campaign Finance Board, Indian Affairs Council, the Attorney General, the Legislature, and Revenue Department, in some cases, is under this jurisdiction. This first page is just going to show you the summary of the changes that I think the two to point to for this committee's purpose are the Campaign Finance Board, $16.4 million in fiscal year 22, and then 19.7 in years after. This information is detailed beginning on page 15 of the fiscal note, and there is a table beginning on page 20 that has more detail. And I would defer to the Campaign Finance Board staff if you have more detailed questions about this. The majority of the costs are related to the the Democracy Dollars program, and they all have some administrative costs and rulemaking, et cetera. The second piece for this committee is under the Secretary of State's office. You can see there's $2 million in fiscal year 22 and $944,000 in continuing costs. And those are largely related in the first year to programming costs. And then the continuing costs are related to printing and mailing for the Democracy Dollars program. And then I also need to just point out that the Attorney General was assigned to this fiscal note on Tuesday evening, I believe. So they're still working on their part of the fiscal note, and that the LDO is still reviewing the Campaign Finance Board and the Secretary of State's office. They have not signed off on those pieces. So if anyone has any questions, I can try, or I would defer to either the Campaign Finance Board or Secretary of State for more detail.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. If you want to unshare your screen, and we'll go to questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, we are now minutes away from being done with committee. We have not really been able to dig into the fiscal note. Ms. Roberts did a nice walkthrough, but there are pieces that are still outstanding, and we have piles of member hands that have been raised. There's no way we're going to get through this. There's just no way. And I certainly understand your desire to move the bill along, but we haven't even made deadline yet, and we're trying to rush this bill out when I've got members that have questions that will go on for a while. And we have given hours and hours and hours in past biennium on single parts of this bill, let alone the aggregated bill. It's got a lot of stuff in it. And I can't in good conscience let this go by without mentioning that this is rushed, and it's not even close to being fair to my members that we're not even going to give them more than 15 minutes worth of questioning time. There are fiscal implications. We haven't heard from campaign finance. We haven't heard from Office of Administrative Hearings. There's a lot of crap in here, sir, that we haven't gotten to. And I think that you, at the very least, should bring this bill back in our next regularly scheduled meeting, because there's so much to talk about here, Mr. Chair. And if we are going to be fair, which has always been the ground rules for elections bills, then you should at least bring this back next Tuesday, bump whatever you've got on the agenda for them. But this is outrageous that we've got so little time to talk about this.
Thank you, Representative Nash. I'm going to get to questions here now. Representative Koznick, you were the first on my list for right now. And again, if we ask questions, if we could be concise and not filibuster while asking questions, we can get through some of this. Representative Koznick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is my first time on this committee, but I've worked with you in the past and know you to be a fair legislator. But I just don't think the 12 minutes of time here for committee questions on a 70-page bill is quite adequate. We didn't even have a walkthrough on the policy part of the bill, but I do appreciate the fiscal note comments. And the cost of this bill is astounding, just for to begin with. But I was looking at a couple of the new parts, page 7, and was wondering how this bill enforces the integrity that non-citizens are not voting with the enhanced requirements for registration of utilizing student identification cards and student fee statements and other states' driver's licenses, if the author could discuss that.
Representative Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, what page 7 does is actually codify current rules that's already in effect. And so you both have to prove residency and also identity. I can turn it over to the Secretary of State if you'd like to hear a little bit more about this, but this actually just codifies current rules. The one thing that it adds is instead of currently under rule, under statute, Minnesota colleges can provide a residential ID or a residential address list. This says that they have to provide that if they're getting state funding so that students can rely on their identification being on that list as opposed to just wonder. But otherwise, this codifies current rules.
Representative Koznick.
Well, I think it should allow us to have more discussion on it a little bit deeper, but I know you want to get this bill out of elections committee, so I'll defer to other members.
Well, Representative Koznick and members, this can always come back, and we could always come back tomorrow morning. We do have the ability to schedule Friday meetings. We could come back tomorrow morning at 8:30 and continue the discussion, or we can move it on and bring it back before it goes to Ways and Means, when we finally get a final note. So next on my list is Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to echo a comment that Representative Nash mentioned earlier. Many portions of this bill have been heard in other committees before. And specifically, I would like to address the fact that in the redistricting portion, much of the language that's in this bill is part of my bill that I went through the process last year, 1605. And that went through many, many amendments in the elections committee last year. Before that language was approved and moved on. So I just would like to say that about that. The questions that I have are regarding outside money. And I don't know if the Campaign Finance Board would like to address this or if Secretary of State Steve Simon would like to address it. But the amount of money that is spent in election, outside money that's spent in elections, in my personal experience, seems as though it has escalated over the years. And I would like to know if one of them would like to address the number of dollars and expenditures, especially from 501c4 organizations, and how that has increased or decreased over the years. And I have a constituent who's watching this election who's very concerned about dark money, whether it's from the Republicans, the Democrats, or independent groups. But I want to make sure that his question is addressed. The other piece is about whether, and I don't know if this goes to the AG or if this goes to the Secretary of State, but do we currently have statutes that prohibit intimidation of our voters and election officials? And how would this change current law, that the provisions in this bill? And especially I was concerned about the election judge who was talking about intimidation with guns in the polling place. So those are my really quick questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I'll ask the AG if he's got a quick answer to that, the last question, and then we'll move on to New Brindley. AG Ellison, are you still here on the line?
Mr. Chair, I had the first question about campaign finance, constituent would really like to
answer. I know. I see if AG's on the line first. If not, I don't see him jumping up. I don't see him on my list of still being here. Mr. Sigurdsson, you want to answer the question about the campaign finance?
Good morning, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I don't know if I have at my disposal a question on how much of the financing of independent expenditures comes from 501c4s. We could look into that question and provide you with information at a later date. I do know that independent expenditures, which are primarily financed by means other than individual contributions, has from 1984 to 2018 increased by about 7,600%. So there is certainly an increase in the amount of money being spent outside of candidates' campaigns to try to influence elections in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, I saw that Mr. Gehring could maybe speak to the question about what's in statute and what the laws are.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clevor, just really quickly there. So there is an existing section of law in the Fair Campaign Practices Act that does govern some aspects of what you might call voter intimidation. It's a section that prohibits certain types of activities that are directed at compelling a person to vote for or against a particular candidate or ballot question. So it's not as broadly written as what's in Representative Greenman's bill. That provision has a gross misdemeanor attached to it. But as I said, the structure you see in Representative Greenman's bill that is directed at actions against voters and elections officials and others would be a new thing for statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gehring and Mr. Sigurdsson.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got 10 minutes and there are a lot of other hands. I promise I will not filibuster, but I do have a lot of very legitimate questions about this bill. Number one, though, I will start. We just heard from Mr. Sigurdsson briefly, but I would, I do think it's valuable for the committee to hear. Mr. Beck indicated that the Campaign Finance Board supports the changes in this bill. And I think we need to know if the Campaign Finance Board, the current Campaign Finance Board, has a position on this bill.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Bradley, the board hasn't considered House File 9 at all. It was introduced after the last board meeting. I'll be updating them at the February meeting of its existence. It is, I believe Mr. Beck was referring to that in the past, the board has suggested legislative changes that would also address the issue of what is or is not an independent expenditure by looking at the definition of express advocacy. The board will be again considering that issue at the February meeting. So at this point, the board has not provided a recommendation as to whether or not they support modification of that language. I'm afraid that it won't really be able to answer that question until after the February meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Brindley, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would also ask, does the Campaign Finance Board currently, this bill would create two new programs, financing programs for the Campaign Finance Board to administer. There is no accompanying appropriation for that administration. Does the Campaign Finance Board have the resources currently to administer these programs?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the fiscal note does increase staffing for the board. The processing of the democracy coupons is a substantial undertaking. And over the time, over the fiscal note, it goes from 2.5 additional positions to 7 additional positions for the board to process those coupons, because in theory, at least, we're talking about millions of coupons. So from that standpoint, the fiscal note does in fact add staff to the board. The other related tasks that the board takes under here in terms of adopting administrative rules, you know, we believe that we can absorb those costs in terms of staff, and the investigative and professional overlay, we don't believe we need additional staff there either, but we are adding 7 positions to process the coupons.
Brindley.
Thank you. So, Mr. Sigurdsson, your position would be, of course, you can't absorb 7 additional positions without additional appropriations.
Correct. And the fiscal note does ask for additional appropriations for that.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Brindley.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next question would be for this. Well, it could be, I suppose, for the bill author or the Secretary of State. On page 21, it talks about, let's see here. Oh, yes. It talks about the permanent absentee ballots, the new program laid out in this bill, and that those ballots will be required to be sent out at least 46 days, and it goes through prior to different elections. My question for the Secretary of State is, how often is the voter roll updated? Is that updated weekly, daily, monthly, with moves, deaths, all of that kind of information? How often is the voter roll updated?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. It's daily. So we subscribe to, or use, I guess you would say, multiple databases, multiple databases, the Social Security database, the Minnesota Department of Health and database, the Department of Public Safety database, so we can keep track of those who lose their eligibility due to a felony conviction. So it's perpetual.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Secretary. My next question would be then on page 24 for early voting, it delineates that ballots could be delivered in person until 8 p.m. Would that be a new requirement for the county auditor the county auditors to be open to the public for additional time on those days? Secretary, or is there already a requirement to be open to the public until 8 o'clock?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. That's a good question. I'm just trying to find, I have the bill summary. I don't have the bill before me. I'm trying to think, actually. I know there's a requirement that they be open business hours, but on election to 8 p.m., I mean, I believe that is all has to be publicly accessible. I'm not sure that that would be a new requirement, but I can get back to you on that one.
Okay. My understanding is that that would be a new requirement, that they would have to be open to the public until 8 o'clock p.m. The other question about counties that I have, and I'm trying to keep this brief, actually, is there was a requirement for...
Representative New Brindley, one second here. Members, it looks like we're going to have to come back tomorrow morning and continue this. We'll be laying this over for till tomorrow morning, and we'll continue the discussion and the question. So Representative New Brindley, if you can continue.
Okay, great. Then on, is it the very next page, it talks about, on page 25, absentee ballot drop boxes. And it looks like this language indicates that there would have to be at least one in every county, perhaps more. And to the bill author, and I guess on both of these items, I didn't see it, but perhaps I missed it. Is there an appropriation in the bill language to counties for the cost of these secure drop boxes and for the additional hours that they would have to be open?
Ms. Greenman.
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, I do not believe there is. I'd have to check with the fiscal note. I do think that that's, I am glad you raised that question after talking to counties. I do want to make sure that we are providing the resources that that our counties need.
Thank
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that we would all be concerned about unfunded mandates to our counties, so I appreciate that. I'm just running through my notes on the bill. I apologize. Oh, and on that same questioning, and I guess perhaps this would be a question for the Secretary of State, or perhaps Representative Greenman, you know already. Hours for early voting, there would have to be additional hours available until 8 p.m. on some evenings as well as some Saturdays. Is that currently required in statute to have those the counties open to the public on those additional days, or is that also an additional cost to the county?
Secretary Simon, I bet you're probably best able to answer that question. Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. That is a current requirement that there have to be some weekend hours, particularly the weekend before the election, if that's what you're asking. So that is a current requirement.
Okay, so this, Mr. Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would require at least two Saturdays, and some additional weeknight hours. So is that more than what is currently required?
Secretary Simon.
I'm muted. Sorry about that. Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, yes, I now see what you're talking about. That would add some additional new hours. That's correct.
Okay.
To do that.
Excellent.
Representative Brindley, New Brindley and members, it's 9:59. I don't know. We need to be out of here by 10 o'clock. We have to be out on time. So members, we're going to lay this bill over for the meeting tomorrow morning. We'll continue the discussion, the questions, and I hope the testifiers and the Secretary of State, the people can be here to answer questions tomorrow morning, because it looks like that's where we're at. So,
Mr. Chair, before we gavel out, I want to make sure that Yeah, I wanted to make sure that we request a roll call on this for tomorrow before we proceed even further. So
we'll okay, be roll call's been roll requested call. There. And Representative Nash, for all bills that to be moved out of committee, they do under this remote hearings, we have to take roll calls. So, but I it'll be noted that you asked for a roll call. And with that, members, it's 10 o'clock on my computer time, so we need to adjourn. And we're going to adjourn till tomorrow morning at 8:30 a.m. And we'll get the staff to send out the proper notifications to everybody. Thank you, members.